This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. In this portion of the show, a journey into the rainforests of Borneo and an exploration of the work of Birute Galdikas. Galdikas is one of anthropologist Louis Leakey's three angels, the others, Jane Goodall and Diane Fossey. Goodall studied chimpanzees, Fossey gorillas. Birute Galdikas has struggled to save the orangutans of Borneo. She went into the jungle to begin her study of the apes in 1971. In 1995, writer Linda Spalding began to follow Galdikas. She tells the story of the journey in her book, A Dark Place in the Jungle, Science, Orangutans, and Human Nature. This is how Spalding defines a follow. A form of research in which the subject is observed from a distance and in which a record is kept of the surroundings, noting moods of subjects as well as environment. Spalding found Galdikas had abandoned science and was profiting from ecotourism. She'd also become a surrogate mother to orphaned orangutans, a role Spalding found troubling. Spalding was accompanied on her follow by her two adult daughters. In addition to being a book about Birute Galdikas and orangutans, it is also about the relationship between humans and animals and mothers and children. Listeners, your questions and comments for Linda Spalding are welcome this afternoon. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else in Illinois or Indiana, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest. Linda Spalding is the author of two novels, Daughters of Captain Cook and The Paper Wife. She is editor of Brick, a literary journal. A Dark Place in the Jungle, Science, Orangutans, and Human Nature is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. Linda Spalding, good afternoon. Welcome.
Hi, Celeste.
Hi. First of all, I think by way of introduction here, maybe you would offer some background on Birute Galdikas. Where was she born? Where did she go to school? And how did she become one of Leakey's angels?
Well, she's had a lot of travel, very varied background. She was born in Lithuania. She is born of Lithuanian parents who actually met, I think, in a German DP camp after the war. And she came to Canada when the refugees were kind of flooding in post-World War II from Eastern Europe and was raised mostly in Toronto, where I now live. She was the oldest of several siblings. And later in her life, she went to Vancouver and then down to L.A., all with the intention of getting herself educated in anthropology. And the Louis Leakey connection, I think, was almost happenstance. He came as a guest lecturer visitor to UCLA, and she attended his lecture and waited until everyone had kind of finished talking to him at the end. And, you know, he was quite elderly and very famous at this point in his career. And she stood there and said, I want to study orangutans. It so happened that he had been looking for someone to do the orangutan thing as Goodall and Fossey had done the chimpanzee and gorilla thing. So it was fortuitous for both of them because he was actually kind of auditioning people for this particular assignment, and he asked her to come and see him the next day. And I've told the story in my book of a kind of, I think it's not apocryphal, but apparently the thing he liked about women as observers of primates is that he thought we were very good observers. He also, no doubt, knew that primates tend to be less threatened by female Homo sapiens than by male Homo sapiens, so being female is an advantage out in the wild. But he thought that we really sort of looked at things differently. And so the tale is that when she went into this place where he was staying, he was playing solitaire. And he said, can you tell me, I've forgotten what the question, something like, can you tell me which are the black cards? And she said, Of course, I can't tell you which are the black cards, but I can tell you that half of them have bent corners. And so he presumably at that moment thought that he'd found, you know, the perfect woman to go off into the wilds of Borneo.
Hmm. And what led you to your interest in Berruti?
Well, actually, I probably knew less about her than just about anybody in the North American continent. I gather she has been a great favorite of many women, you know, kind of a hero. But I didn't know much about her, and I was approached by a Canadian publisher who said she thought I would find her interesting for various reasons. And I said, yeah, but I don't write nonfiction. I'm not a biographer. Because she had sort of proposed a biography. Excuse me, I'm recovering from the flu.
No,
and this publisher said, well, whatever you do, it's going to be interesting. Why don't you, you know, let us kind of commission you and we'll give you a travel budget. And those were the magic words for me. And see what happens. I think that's probably every writer's dream.
Yeah. You used a follow to study her. How did you decide that that would be the way to do it?
Well, it was kind of by default because originally I had contacted her in Borneo and I had spoken to her by phone. She teaches in Vancouver a few months of each year, so I'd spoken to her there. And we had agreed that the easiest way for us to connect would be in L.A. during her book tour because she was in touring her own book. So I flew to L.A., and then I couldn't get anybody to let me see her. She was kind of cosseted by publicists and various sorts, and I was told that if I wanted to see her, I should just come to her readings. You know, so I ended up spending a week kind of driving around, going from one reading to another, and eventually got her publicist to say that I could have lunch with them at one of these things, which turned out to be standing up in the hall and eating sandwiches out of a kind of little bag with 150 students asking for her signature, so it wasn't quite what I had envisioned. But anyway, finally I did sort of manage to have a few hours over dinner alone with her and, well, with two of her children. And it just became clear that she was going to continue to be very elusive and not very communicative and did not want to work with me on this book, which I thought I envisioned as a kind of book about motherhood and interspecies relationships and things like that. She, you know, didn't want me to come and see her clinic and her so forth and so on. So I just thought I'll do it in the way that she does orangutans, which is kind of from afar, and looking at the results of her work and sort of doing, a portrait almost in relief or by negative inference, seeing all the surround that has occurred from this 25-year stint she's had in Borneo.
Today, what do you think of her?
Ooh, that's direct. Well, I think that she's very complicated.
Uh-huh.
I think she is quintessentially human in the way that we all are. I think she's got herself into a very, very odd and troubling situation in that part of the world. She's been outlawed. She's been exiled from the camp that she really created to study orangutans. And as a result of that, she's become a kind of rogue primatologist in the sense that she's working with orangutans illegally. She is working with orangutans that have been taken out of the national park and are now residing at her house in very unsafe situations and conditions. And she's on the outs with the scientific community for the most part, and certainly with the primate, you know, community of Indonesia, such as it is, which is fragile already. And the orangutans are, you know, in really dire straits.
What is the situation of the orangutans in Indonesia and Borneo?
Well, since I finished my book, which was, I guess, in 97, 98, I mean, I was there sort of the first summer of the fires when things began to get really scary. Suharto, you know, collapsed, and Habibi moved in. And in a way, I think we sort of thought, oh, hooray, that things may get better. Because the problem with the rainforest in Borneo is that it is controlled by very, very corrupt forces. And Hassan, Bob Hassan, who was Suharto's, you know, right-hand chum, was actually controlling the part of Borneo that Galdikas works in. But the strange thing is that when Suharto fell and Habibi came in, the poachers sort of took over. The corrupt forces that had controlled the forest and controlled all the timber concessions were in such disarray that things actually became worse. And it's now become just kind of, you know, wide open field for poachers, both poaching orangutans and taking out trees. So, and the fires, of course, have been disastrous. And the problem with orangutans is that they must have this habitat. They must have the rainforest or they can't survive. And they need huge quantities of it. So it's not looking good.
How much territory does an orangutan need? I think thousands of...
Yeah, I've got
acres?
That book and I can't tell you anymore. But it's they're considered a very solitary primate because they need so much. You see, they eat really only fruits for the most part, and twigs and leaves, and they aren't carnivores at all. So they have to have immense amounts of forest in order to get enough fruit to survive. So they don't hang out in tribal groups. They're pretty lonely creatures. It tends to be mothers and their infants and toddlers. You know, a mother, an infant clinging to her, and maybe a young toddler. So that's it.
Yeah.
And then she'll need this huge bit of rainforest. And then, you know, 10 miles away.
I believe is saying that Biruta Galdikas had shipwrecked herself. And I can see that in a sense, but I also wonder to what extent she didn't really have control of the ship. And she is there with these animals that are also, in a sense, in a very real sense, shipwrecked.
Well, she didn't have control of the ship. Of course she didn't. But she had control of... I mean, she made many choices over that 25-year period, which essentially backed her into a corner. She did not get along well with the park authorities and was very competitive with them. Tanju Puting, where she worked, was originally a nature reserve. That's a kind of, you know, legal term for a more or less safe place for animals and trees. And then it became an actual national park while she was there. And I think she was responsible for some of that. But when it became a national park, it came under the auspices of, you know, the forestry ministry. And they wanted to have authority over the animals and over what was happening, and they eventually decided that the way she was working with orangutans wasn't really helpful. To just do a little moment of background on that, Galdikas had gone there as a scientist to study the wild orangutan and had been sort of inveigled on by the Indonesian government to take on the care of orphan orangutans who were being confiscated by the government. They were orphans because most of them at that time were pets. Somebody had shot the mother and taken the baby as a pet, and they were very popular pets, particularly with the upper classes. This is still the case in Taiwan and places like that. And so there were all these orphans, and they thought, well, while we've got this national park and we've got this expert primatologist, why don't we give them to her and she can send them back into the jungle as proper orangutans. And so she became more and more and more and more involved in that and less involved in the study of the actual wild ones that were out there in the farther reaches of the park. At one point, I mean, there were probably upwards of 50 or 60 at any one time at this camp, what she had named Camp Leakey. And eventually, as I started to say, that the park department just decided that this wasn't working, and there was a better method. I might call it the tough love method of rehabilitating orangutans, but Galdikas, for better or for worse, was basically raising these infant orangutans like human babies, feeding them human food, cooked food, carrying them around, having them become very attached to their human caretakers. And they weren't going back, you know. they wanted no part of going back into the jungle after that kind of upbringing. So that was the first kind of crossing of the ways, methods of orangutan raising. And then things kind of went from bad to worse. She got involved in a hotel to bring in ecotourists. She just became more involved in kind of bringing people in and raising huge amounts of money, fundraising, and keeping more and more orangutans around to keep the tourists happy, so that things got to be really quite out of hand. So, you know, it's a mixed bag of complaint and responsibility.
Why do you think she started to mother the orangutans the way she did?
Well, first of all, they're enormously beguiling. There's nothing quite as darling. I mean, I suppose pandas or something, but if you've ever been up close to a really young orangutan, they're incredibly, you know, love-worthy. They just have these huge eyes and eyelashes, and you just, you know, they want to hang on to you and so forth. So there's all of that for those of us who love to nurture things. They're quite rewarding. And she became very attached to the first few that I think she took care of. You know, she really raised them. I mean, she was also having a child at about that time. And these orangutans were sort of sleeping with her and being carried on her back or her arms every day, every minute of the day, and she was feeding them and so forth. So I think, you know, it's very addicting to nurture something that closely. And she no doubt felt that she was doing the right thing by them. You know, and I think that some of us are better at that stuff than others and like it more than others.
What is her relationship like with her own children? She has three children, two sons and a daughter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she had a son by her first husband, who went to Borneo with her and who then eventually left with the baby. So, I mean, one of the first very difficult choices she had to make was whether she was going to keep her family intact and go to Canada with her husband and child, or whether she was going to stay in the rainforest with the orangutans. And she chose the latter, which I think is an enormously telling act. I mean, I think she's a very determined woman who wanted this life with the orangutans more than any other life, you know, that she, this was a huge sacrifice. And later she married an Indonesian man, a Dayak, by whom she had two children, a son and a daughter, and they, for the most part, live there, although her daughter travels with her. She's quite young. I mean, I suppose she's about 14 now, but she goes pretty much everywhere Baruti goes to different schools, you know, different times of the year and so forth. And I think that her son, Freddie, stays in Indonesia most of the time. That's the sense I get, anyway.
What about the relationships between Galdikas's children and the orangutans?
I don't know. You know, I mean, poor Binti, the first baby, was kind of made famous by this picture on the cover of National Geographic when he was about 1 1/2, bathing with a baby orangutan in a little pail. And, you know, he was kind of the National Geographic baby for a decade or something. I don't know. I don't know what the I mean I've heard tales, but I haven't witnessed in person anything that took place between those three children and the orangutan. So it would be unfair for me to to guess.
Yeah. You know, this woman is complex. She's determined. She's it seems to me in a world of trouble right now, or has been for some time. And she's very aloof. She didn't want to cooperate with you. And it was very difficult for you to really make connection with her. How did you get around that problem and try to the best of your ability, understand her and her world?
Well, I guess I decided, Celeste, to just really focus on her work and on the place and what the effects of her work had been. I'm very interested in what happens when particularly we, North Americans or Europeans, go into other places in any kind of form of colonialism. Many of our ventures into other worlds have been with good intentions, you know, all the kind of missionary efforts and all that stuff. You know, even now, whatever, Peace Corps or Canadian development groups, that kind of thing. I've always been fascinated by what really happens as a result of that stuff. And So I guess I decided that I would look at that, and I would leave alone as much as possible her personal life, because it didn't seem fair. I mean, she's alive. This isn't a kind of open season on a person who's already, you know, died, and we can look at her life in that way. I had at hand two of her girlhood friends in Toronto, and decided not to interview them. And that was just sort of the way I went about it. In fact, I met her very close friend in Indonesia, and although I talked to her about something that woman is doing on her own, I didn't talk to her about their relationship or any of that stuff, because it just seemed to me the only way I could do this in a kind of upright feminist fashion was to look at the work and leave the personal stuff alone. I mean, believe me, I heard, you know, all kinds of things, and I could have written a very different kind of book, yeah. but that wasn't it.
This is a very personal book, though, when it comes to you.
Yeah, well, that was the other part of the equation, because it's always seemed to me that, I mean, I personally like, when I'm reading nonfiction, to know who's writing it and where they're coming from, and it seems to me fair if you're talking about somebody else to give a little of your own self away too, you know, make yourself a bit exposed. So I thought that's the other thing I'll do, is I'll actually examine my own soul while I'm examining hers.
Would you read an excerpt from the book? I would like very much for you to read.
Oh, I was afraid you were going to ask me that, and I actually don't have one sitting.
Maybe you can talk with us about this. The book grabbed me right from the outset, the prelude, where we know we're off on a journey, and we're going to find out some things about the person who's telling the story and the subject of the story. And I
you
think,
read it.
Well, I'll start it. I haven't practiced.
It's very plain English.
Yeah. I am standing on a dock in Borneo when my point of view changes. From this moment, everything seems to be covered in a new color, one I have not yet learned to name. First, I hear Kristen calling, quickly. She's my daughter, and the urgency in her voice is compelling, although I can hear another, smaller scream as well. Then I'm on the dock, looking down at the water and weeds of the swamp, where there is a red-patterned snake with a frog in her mouth. It's the frog who is crying. The sound is small but heart-rending. No wonder. The snake's jaws are locked around the frog's flat foot. They're chewing. The foot is disappearing. At this rate, it will take a long time, but as the foot goes, so will go the leg, then the rest of the frog. There are two men on the dock. One of them is Yadi, the driver of our boat, who refuses to get involved with the snake. Poisonous, he tells us, very poisonous. The other man works at the lodge at the end of this dock and is enjoying a break from his duties. We've all been relaxing in the way people do who are more or less ignoring each other, but the frog cries frantically. The snake continues to swallow. I'm paralyzed. I remember watching my other daughter, Esta, almost drown and being paralyzed then, too, looking down into the water in the same way, frozen. Who am I to deny the snake her lunch? And how interfere with the fate of a frog who is suddenly quiet as if resigned to being eaten alive? Who am I to interfere even in the way the local people on the dock shrug off a cry of pain? The young man is amused by our interest, and when he leaps up with a piece of lumber in his hand, I suddenly fear for the snake, who has earned her lunch the hard way and who is uncoiled in the underbrush, swallowing trustingly as we stand above her on the dock. Then the chunk of lumber comes down hard, cutting through the brush and just missing the snake, who coughs up the frog and slides away. We can see the frog, with a glob of blood on its back, shove itself back into the brown river. This is the moment when the unnameable color saturates water, and trees and the rice paddies lying beyond them, where the rainforest has been cut away in order that people may eat. Even the sky with its eagles and kingfishers is a strange hue. Until now, I have understood myself and most things. Really beautifully written and very powerful. What did you learn about yourself on this journey?
Well, the point of that little bit, which is kind of the key to the book, is that the book has mostly to do with our desire to save things and our desire as a species, really, to take care of other species, which seems to me fairly unique on this planet. We are incredibly destructive, but we are also, incredibly kind of redemptive. And yet, and that all seems very simple and interesting, but simple. And I'd always thought, I'm one of these nice people who likes to save things. I scoop up puppies and kittens from the pavement when they've been hit by a car or whatever. So Galdikas and I and others do this. This is okay, and this is what we are, and so forth. And then it suddenly occurred to me around that incident that the business of saving things is very complicated. In that particular moment, who were we going to save? Saving the frog meant that the snake was not going to eat, and so forth. And I guess it was just that sort of flash of that also took in the whole rest of this around. When you put a national park in a place like southern Borneo, it changes everybody's lives. When you tell people they can't cut trees and they can't eat the animals, and in fact, they can't mine for gold, which is a very toxic process, which ends up killing everything in the rivers. You're always having to make decisions about this is better than that, this is more important than that. This is the kind of stuff that hard ecology is dealing with. And I guess I'd sort of tried not to look at it very closely, or confront my own feelings of ambivalence about it all. So there I was.
Hmm. You know, given the environment, the economic and political realities and human frailties and our desire to do good and to save things, should we be surprised by what happened? Has happened to Burundi Galdikas?
No, I don't think. Well, maybe surprised, because we always. I've also got a kind of subtext in there about heroes and what we expect of them, you know. And I think that being Galdikas has not been easy. It's been lonely, and it's been very tempting. The thing that I learned, another thing I learned about myself, and of course it wasn't an entirely new lesson because I've done a bit of traveling in sort of third world places, is that, you know, you immediately have an enormous ability to influence things when you come from outside into a place like Borneo or even Indonesia. Just the fact that we're carrying, you know, amounts of cash that are unheard of, or, you know, amounts of credit that is unknown, or huge bits of camera equipment, whatever. I mean, the things that we take so for granted are enormously strange and influential and kind of awe-inspiring in lots of places. And if you were to live your life in one of those places and still keep all those connections and all those outside powers, you know, you could be a kind of divinity very quickly. It'd be very tempting. You know, Henderson, the Rain King, that kind of thing.
Well, it certainly reminds one of Conrad's Heart of Darkness.
Yeah.
Where we have an agent of a European trading company losing himself in Africa and becoming a divine figure.
Right. I think it's hard for us to imagine how much power and influence among the people of her part of Borneo Galdikas actually wields. She has an entire village full of people who are kind of, you know, employed or in other ways connected to her. And she's, of course, put this part of Borneo on the map, and she brings in Hollywood people regularly. So there's all of that, and of course that's very, very exciting. And those are just tiny things. Then to be running a hotel and, you know, having many, many tourists with many, many dollars coming in and out of the park all the time. It's all pretty, pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it would be easy to do all that and think that you were helping, that you were doing the right thing, up to a point.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking today with writer Linda Spalding. Her book, her latest book, A Dark Place in the Jungle, Science, Orangutans, and Human Nature. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to join us this afternoon with questions, you're more than welcome. 333-9455 is the number in Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, call us toll-free 1-800-222-9455. I'd like to go back to the idea of Heart of Darkness for a moment. And at the end of that story, the storyteller decides not to tell the man's widow what happened. Did you ever consider not telling this story or telling it in a fictionalized account?
I think I feel like writing it in a fictionalized account still sometimes, when I think there's so many things I can't say, you know, the constraints of partly good manners and partly libel laws have really made this a very tempered tale, you know. But certainly the thing I said about the sort of personal life stuff, I think, might be a bit like the Conrad story, in that, you know, there's just some things that I just don't want to go there, you know. And I don't know what secrets Galdikas has from her own, you know, her own friends and family, so I imagine not many. So it isn't quite the same situation. But you know, certainly there's been plenty of opportunity to sort of tell the world things that are not going to benefit anybody. So I suppose there's a little similarity in that.
Yeah. I imagine this experience has made a mark on you as a writer of fiction. Is that the case?
Well, I don't know. I haven't written a fictional book since then. I'm working on a novel actually with my daughter, Esta, and that's going to be an entirely new experience. What I've done since this book is compile and edit a book by Riska, who was our guide in Borneo. And that book has been now published in Canada by Knopf, and was just actually nominated for a huge prize on the West Coast called the Pacific Rim Prize, given by Kiriyama. So that's been really exciting because we, you know, this lovely book called Riska, Memories of a Dayak Girlhood, is now in existence, you know, just because we met this gal, and it's lovely to kind of have books happen, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not that they just happen, but anyway, you know, that they get engendered by your experiences and stuff. So,
any plans for that to be published in the United States?
Well, we hope so. That's what we're hoping will happen now.
Yeah, especially
it's been published in Holland and in Canada, and so maybe there's a future for it.
Yeah. Well, tell us about your relationship with your daughters and this project. Why did you invite them along? And they stuck with you through the writing of this book, right?
They did, yeah. They're still with me. They didn't. I made three trips. They only made one. I think they were kind of less emotionally involved. It's funny. I was just talking to Kristen last night on the phone, and we were reminiscing and thinking about it. Esta has done a lot more travel, really, than any of us, because she's spent many, many summers in Europe as a guide. But Kristen and I have tended to travel in places like Mexico and Guatemala and Asia. She went to Sri Lanka the first time I went. So she had a kind of different view of the world than Esta, I think, and we were just discussing that, sort of what Indonesia meant to them as an experience, a kind of life-changing experience. It may have been more of a surprise for Esta than it was for us. But it was great for me having them there, partly because they sort of act as my consciences, you know. They kick me around and say, no, you shouldn't do that, and you should do that, and you should tip this guy, and you shouldn't tip that one. And, you know, Kristen was studying the Indonesian language a little bit to get us through that stuff. We had our assignments. We each had special sort of responsibilities, and mainly they were wonderful company. And, of course, once we met Riska, who was actually Kristen's age, we became this sort of group of four women, you know, one old gal, me, and three youngies, and we lived on a boat together, and it was just an utterly different kind of experience than I'd expected.
And did the four of you talk about mother-daughter relationships?
We did. The funny thing about that first trip was that I think Riska hung out with my daughters most of the time. You know, they were kind of girlishly chattering and talking about which boys were cutest along the river and that kind of stuff. And I felt rather old and unwieldy. But then when I went back the second time, and Riska and I lived in a kind of hut in the rainforest, in the park, on land, you know, for several weeks, we became very, very close. That's when we kind of started working on her book. And at that point, I learned about her child, who was a kind of secret child. I learned about her relationship with her parents. You know, I talked about my own children in a different way than I had when they were there. And so there's been a lot of exchange between us, kind of. Although she'd really never been out of Borneo at that point. So,
Birutė Galdikas, with her children and then the orphans that she has adopted, the orangutans, really speaks to a need on the part of some or most for children. Did you talk with Riska about that?
No, I'm not sure, actually, I'm not entirely sure that's a concept Riska would understand or share.
Uh-huh.
Maybe she would. She has very particular views about Galdikas because she's known her off and on over the years. And, but I think that's a very interesting, point. I think that many of us, I mean, what I came to feel about myself, and when you asked me why did I take my kids, I mean, it's easy to say, you know, company and so on and so forth, but I had to realize by the very end of the project, as I really got into the nitty-gritty of my own soul, that I was quite addicted to my view of myself as their mother. I was a single mother for a very long time, and virtually raised them alone. And as they grew up and grew away from me, I was feeling enormously bereft and kind of without identity. You know, who am I if I'm not that? I may be a writer and everything, but that's not really deep down core self, you know. And those kids were kind of how I knew myself. I mean, I had them when I was really young. And so then I started thinking about that in terms of losing your hold on Camp Leakey and on the orangutans that you've raised and the whole way you are known in the world. Because if I was known as a single mother, Galdikas was known as, you know, the adoptive mother of orangutans. That's her whole thing. So to lose that must have been enormously destabilizing for her and probably terrifying, both personally and professionally. And I think, you know, the fact that she's now bringing animals in one way or another out of the park, one of whom was her very first kind of grandchild, the first orangutan born to her first orphan, is now living in the attic of her house, presumably, if she's still alive. And that was a 27-year-old orangutan who'd always lived in the park and was very, very adapted to life there, you know. So that sort of gave me a clue that this woman needs the orangutans more than they need her. You know?
Yeah.
So I think, yes, you're right. It's got something to do with needing to be a mother, you know?
Yeah. Has she responded to the book?
No. She's suing me for libel for an excerpt that was published in Outside Magazine. So I guess that's a response.
Mm. And what about the government of Indonesia or the Orangutan Foundation International?
Well, the government of Indonesia has responded in rather interesting ways because there was enough flack happening around the time that I finished the book and things were beginning to surface that they actually sent in a team of investigators to find out what she was doing at her private home and discovered that there were 89 orangutans living virtually in her sort of kitchen and backyard, which is an appalling concept, and they've, you know, made every effort to shut her down. You have to understand the Indonesians and the fact that, you know, they don't like conflict and they don't like open hostilities. So probably this will go on indefinitely. But basically, the government got into the act and did an investigation, which is surprising in itself, and
mm-hmm.
that report, most of it is in the back of the book.
Right.
The thing that they did. So, yeah, I think, you know, that there was some reaction on that part. OFI has been busy putting things on their website to kind of refute. I think without directly talking about the book, they just try and refute everything.
Hmm. We're out of time. Thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for your interest.
Wonderful book.
Thanks, Celeste. And thank you for your reading. I love that.
Well, it's my pleasure. It's a beautiful passage. It really, it just grabs you.
Oh, great.
Thanks so much.
Yes, thank you.
Linda Spaulding has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Look for her book, A Dark Place in the Jungle, Science, Orangutans, and Human Nature. It is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill.